Series 3, Episode 1, and I'm speaking with Richard Kapener. Well, let's get started. Let's have the typical question, typical starter question. I'm interested to know why people decide that they're going to be poets, because it seems like a lot of hard work for no return. I mean, I suppose the obvious answer to this question that some people have given is just, well, you do it because you feel a compulsion to do it. Would that be true of you, or is there some moment in your life where you thought, I have to be a poet?
There's certainly compulsion. In terms of the sort of side quests you hinted at there, in terms of the financial aspects and the status of poetry in popular culture. I mean, I'll give sort of people the straight story first in terms of how I came to write. And it's very much linked to music for me. Very musical family. Like my dad was a military musician for 9 years in the days when you could join the army just to play music in the marching bands. And my brother and sister are very, very musical. And because they're quite a bit older than me, like I think my brother is 10 years older, my sister is 8 years older, or thereabouts. As younger siblings do, you kind of inherit music from them. So I was quite precocious musically, I'd say, and just kind of hoovered up whatever I could get. And then when I hit the teenage years, where I think we start to formulate our identities a bit more, I kind of realized that I was quite significantly into electronic music, or like, you know, as all teenagers do, we get into some shit when we're younger, and then it kind of gets refined over the course of growing up. So when I say sort of getting into it, I mean whatever was being played on the radio at the time, like proper, you know, crappy dance tunes. And again, this is more my brother's influence, because he was living in London at the time and was kind of at least passingly aware of the club scene. I kind of moved from popular music to what I was sort of broadly called techno. Whether that's what we think of as techno, like Ryan Atkins and Jeff Mills, but also Aphex Twin, Square Pressure, Boards of Canada, the Warp Records kind of staple. The interesting thing about electronic music is where you can very much trace rock and its different strands to the blues. And if you try and do that with electronic music, you end up in the avant-garde. It's just like that's the way it is. I mean, you trace back techno far enough, you end up in musique concrète, and sort of after that, the early experiments of synthesizers, and then earlier than musique concrète, maybe I think things like the theremin and contemporary composition. And so it was just kind of like a simple sidestep from there, and I ended up in the territory of John Cage and Feldman and Stockhausen and so on. And so it was very much three stepping stones. Like there was music, and that got me into the wider avant-garde, and it was the avant-garde that got me into writing poetry. It made me realize that writing could be daring and exciting, whereas I think what I had grown up with was BBC adaptations of Jane Austen or whatever we were taught at school. And I can look at that material now and appreciate it, but certainly at the time, it wasn't something that was going to thrill me. So when it kind of became clear that I didn't have the same musical talent as the rest of my family, but I perhaps could yield words around, I kind of pursued that with the same vigour and passion and discipline as I saw the musicians around me. Because I studied sound engineering when I left school, so I had a lot of musicians around me just outside of the family as well. In terms of maybe the wider things you were talking about, I mean, certainly a compulsion. Like I can look back at being a child and see just having a very specific relationship to language, whether that be growing up with, like, through different times in life, having a speech impediment and seeing the effect that can have socially, and language having this quite strange power to offend, not because you're saying anything offensive, but the form of language can itself offend. It seems, I wouldn't have explained it in those terms as a 7-year-old, but looking back, I think that's what became clear to me. And then also growing up in profoundly negative fundamentalist religious environment in a contemporary Protestant context that I later ran away from. But what is the point of Protestantism relative to form an entire doctrine around a book? And it's to form an entire doctrine around language, and language having this cosmic weight attached to it in terms of the doctrines of inerrancy and infallibility. So language is always a deeply problematic tangle. So it was kind of inevitable that I'd, you know, try and throw myself into that tangle to kind of partly kind of work through the knots. But I also mean it in an almost like an erotic bonded sense of having that pleasure of language and being sort of immersed in it and tangled up in it. In terms of the financial component to all this, I mean, you know, I've got a day job. it's fine. Like I've tried to sort of gear my life so I can work and pursue writing. I did try and be an academic for a short while, and that's a whole other story that, you know, it'll make this whole response too long if I went into it. But ultimately, when I decided to stop pursuing that, I was ultimately glad that I did, because I don't have to kiss any ass, which is nice. I don't have to be too polite when it comes to the more academic material, or be too beholden to it. Although I don't mean that dismissively. It's terribly important to me. But why? I mean, yes, the compulsion, but I think we'll probably come on to talking around this theme later, but the challenges of writing and then not being 100% sure of how many people are reading, and publishing and knowing how many people are reading, which is worse. And I came to feel that the act of writing itself, even if minimal people read it, still has an effect in the world. Like the more joy and dissent and beauty and difference we put in the world, then necessarily the more joy and beauty and difference and dissent is put into the world. And so that's the thing that keeps me stubbornly going. And books, I keep thinking of books as sticky. Like we put books out, and then 10, 20 years pass, and for whatever reason, they might end up in a secondhand bookstore, and then they'll end up in somebody else's home, and then it might repeat that process. And I like the idea that books, they really stick. And I think that's also a degree of comfort, knowing that as a writer and a publisher, you know.
Yeah, but I can relate a lot to this. I also very nearly went down the path of being an academic, and I spent many years regretting the fact I moved away from it, until recently I've decided that I'm glad I didn't do that. Although the pay looks pretty good, so maybe I still regret it a bit. Another thing you say about starting with music, I relate to that. And a lot of people I've spoken to on this podcast came to poetry through music in one way or another, which is interesting. Have you heard this notion that it seems to hold true, that most of the music you're going to listen to through the rest of your life is the music you were really interested in when you were 14 years old, like specifically when you were 14. Have you found that?
I've heard people say that. I agree with it, with the caveat that I had to perambulate background, because I feel like it's the same with writing. The sort of stuff I wrote when I was 14 to 18 is kind of what I've gone back to writing in the last 5 years, but I had to take the big route around for you know, whatever, mostly silly reasons. But so yes, I do. I mean, Aphex Twin just had a new album out, so you know, happy days. And I'm still a big Boards of Canada and Broadcast fan, so it seems like that's still a it seems like it's all true, you know.
Yeah, well, same with me. Every time a band that I was into when I was 14, of the few that are still going, when something new comes out from them, it's always exciting. I get that same excitement. I sort of go back to being a 14-year-old.
But you saw NoFX recently, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, because that was my... See, I mean, I was born in 81. I think you're a little bit younger than me.
I'm 86, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would have been 14 in 95.
Which
of course was right in the middle of that punk explosion. So yeah, it's all those bands.
Growing up in Gloucester, when I hit 14, punk and metal was huge in Gloucester. NoFX were one of the big bands that all the punks were into. So it was quite endearing to see that they're still going.
Yeah, just about. It was their last UK gig that I saw a couple of months ago. So they are ending now.
Okay.
Yeah, but there are a few others going. Rancid.
I don't know. Rancid. Yeah. I mean, again, like, these are just the social groups I was in, although I wasn't a punk. But yeah, NoFX, Rancid, ska punk was quite big, so early Offspring. But also just metal generally, like Marilyn Manson was quite big. Slipknot, when they first started, were huge. Rammstein. So yeah, it was a culture I had to be able to navigate through, even if I wasn't into it necessarily, you know.
Yeah. Well, I get it. You know, one of my best friends at the time he could understand why I liked it, and he was into I suppose more your kind of music. I don't know if you like, did you like Prodigy? Because we had the Prodigy, which seemed like it was somewhere in between.
Yeah, it was like music and punk aesthetic to rave music, wasn't it? So I could never get the Prodigy when I was younger. Since their lead singer passed away, when was that? 2019, I think. I did sort of revisit a lot of that material and found worth in it, and sort of I really, really got, you know, got him as a I think he was just this little dyslexic punk who just was just like, fuck everything, and then he got into the rave culture and, you know, defined a popular counterculture in the 90s, which is a huge thing. So I could certainly appreciate them now, even if, you know, back in those earlier days I didn't get them, you know.
So another thing you say is, I think I instigated it, is the idea that you feel a compulsion to create poetry. I think this also applies to publishing, certainly from my experience. So I'm interested to know what made you decide that you weren't just content with writing poetry, you wanted to start making books and publishing other people as well.
I mean, ultimately, it's something that just kind of erupts from your unconscious, which is a horrible answer, but that's kind of what it is. It's just something you're driven to do. I mean, I'm rolling off of that. I am interested in the community making of things and the infrastructure that we can build around things. Like, something Charles Bernstein says that I'm very fond of is he talks about how porous the poetry world is, and you can enter it quite easily compared to most most other stratas of society, and you can affect it quite easily as well. And I think that's quite an attractive in that you can redesign it in your own little weird corner of the world. And it's also just a good way to engage with people. And a lot of the material that was really valuable to me when I was a younger reader, if I'm not seeing that now, or if I'm not seeing that in the UK, then I can hopefully, you know, fill that gap. So that's very much the drive and ethos of Hem Press, which is the press I run, to just kind of be a part of the fun.
Well, that's very important, and it has to be fun, and quite often it isn't. We'll get onto that, but I think I first became aware of you when you were doing a journal before the press,
Tower Notice Board. Yeah,
was that the first thing you'd done in publishing, or was there something before?
It's the first thing I'd done that publicly. I had done, like, one of the places Hem Press came from was when I was at uni, so this is around 22 years old. I started making very small ephemeral artist books, and so that was like my first, although like nobody read them, that was my first decisive kind of gesture towards publishing. And I did a little bit of student work at uni as well, around writers' collectives and public performances. But then there was a big break, and then when I had like an 8 to 10 year break from public poetry, and then when I sort of came back from that and decided to engage again and be more public, it felt like the right time to start a journal, not least because of the pandemic.
Yeah, well, a lot of people, and again, there's stuff to say about this, but a lot of people saw the pandemic as an opportunity to get more involved in the community.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that it was really, really good for Babel to have that. Yeah, so that was the first thing that I did on a quote unquote big public scale. And that was also like simultaneously the first time I became aware of Pentaract, because writing constraints and visual poetry is such a big part of the avant-garde historically and in the contemporary practice as well. And it was exciting to see a press that was specializing in this, just those two things, and seeing how valuable that was alongside you publishing folk like Christian and Sasha and many others who were shaping the conversation around a contemporary avant-garde. So that was very, very exciting to find you guys.
Yeah, well, thank you. And in fact, I mean, my memory is hazy, but I think if I can pinpoint when I first heard of Babel Tower Notice Board, it would have been when you published Rachel Smith, who was a friend of ours, and we published her books. And I can't remember if it was something from one of the books we published, but certainly I know that you're a big fan of her work.
Oh, she's amazing. I think the very first thing we published was an essay by her. I think this is, I mean, my memory can be so bad with these things, but it was about tracings. And the second book you put out by her was to do with Babel, not the journal, but Babel Tower itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, amazing. The thing I love about her work is it seems to feed into a specifically British visual poetry. I don't mean that in a nationalistic way, but certainly if we kind of orient British visual poetry around Bob Cobbing, as many people do, you know, he, at the back end of his career, he did reduce the act of writing to just the trace and the abstract imprint. And so I very much see Rachel's work as a continuation from that kind of lineage, is too fancy a word, but that practice. Like I really, really appreciate sort of thinking about it in those terms, because it also breathes a lot of life into Essenic writing, which I think can sometimes get itself into a dead end.
Yeah,
and so I'm really, really grateful to have published Rachel and to have read. I'm looking at both the books up there now. To have published, to have read the books that you published.
Well, thank you again. And so what was the motivation then for saying you'd had enough with your journal and you wanted to start a press, you wanted to start making books? Is this just masochism? That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, it probably is. So we can't get away from the pandemic and how the impact that had on many journals. Because I think many of us, if we weren't furloughed, we, you know, say this quietly, but we didn't have a lot of work to do in our day jobs. So we had to do something. When the pandemic ended, I felt that the poetry scene changed shape quite significantly. It seemed like a lot of writers were in a sort of a pressure cooker, and they were kind of desperate to engage not only with their writing and their practice, but the writing and the practice of others. And when all that external pressure, i.e. the pandemic, went away because of the various lockdowns being lifted, a lot of the writers dissipated out as well. And so there's that. And I think we'll maybe talk a little bit more about that when it comes to book publishing. But the other aspect as well is with Babel, it was very much it very, very much used the lockdown. And I thought about it in ritual terms, where we we're facing this tremendous challenge of economic collapse and fear for each other, not necessarily because of the virus, but just because it exposed how utterly useless and self-interested the structures around us have always been.
Mm.
And so Babel was very much meant to be a ritual, in that it was meant to create abundance, and it was meant to create this anarchic joy and buoyancy in the face of all of this this horror. And the way we did that was both in terms of the work we published. Like I think we published four pieces a week. We did a podcast every month, and we did a reading series every quarter. So that was exhausting. Even if it wasn't, even if I didn't have a day job, that sort of a schedule for publishing is mental.
Yeah.
And so that was very, very challenging. But again, it was the point of Babel. Like, very, people very kindly said to me, "Why are you publishing so much?" And that was my slightly mad but sincere answer, because it's a ritual for abundance. But the other aspect of that as well is we presented ourselves in a very irreverent way. And I think, again, I'd come out of a long hiatus from engaging in the poetry world anyway. And so I think I maybe had a lot of baggage around how stuffy the poetry world can be. And so for better or worse, we were very anarchic on social media. We presented the work very irreverently. We were very hypersexual. We were semi-confrontational. We attacked ourselves and the positions of authority that editors hold just as lovingly as we mocked the rest of poetry. And so that was very, very much the ethos and the vibes we were trying to put out. What that means is that sort of energy can't be sustained. Like it was a drag performance. It was meant to be this kind of irreverent persona.
Oh, I get it. I get that. Yeah. I mean, it's necessary, I think, to try to do something that's going to stir things up a bit in a scene that can often feel like it's stagnating.
Sure. Well, I was joking with somebody a few months ago, because with all of those people in the social media space, inevitably there was a lot more controversy and a lot more arguments and a lot of all that. And even at that time, I was joking with a friend, like I was actively trying to get ourselves cancelled. I mean, it never happened. Like even in
that, I know. Me too. I've tried this several times. It doesn't seem to be. I think it's exaggerated, this whole cancellation thing.
Sure. No, I think there's a nuanced conversation to have around cancellation. I mean, I don't mean to say that, you know, I'm not a Reddit pro, like thumping the table being like, why is everything being cancelled? It's gone mad. Like I'm not saying that, obviously, but by the same token, we were intentionally irreverent. And that sort of energy couldn't be sustained. So, and then also the assistant editor wanted to go do her own thing. And so it was just the right time. In terms of why Hemp Press, I mean, it was something I wanted to do when I was 22. Like that was the sort of energy behind creating those artist books at uni. And I think if I wanted to start a press now and I didn't have a day job, I'd handle it far better. But certainly when I was young and I didn't know anything about publishing, I didn't necessarily think to start, you know, handmade leaflets or anything like that. I wanted to publish perfect bound books and I didn't have any money. I was in quite severe poverty for five, 8 years. I was almost homeless a number of times. So, you know, my attention was on other, it was on other things. And then when Babel ended and I had already had a little bit of experience with how to typeset, how to interact with writers, how to advertise, a journal in the case of Babel, I had a little bit more of a taste. And I had books out then as well. So I knew what it was like to work for a publisher and to look at a proof and what that process was like. And then, so that just kind of made me realize this is, it's not complicated, but it's complex. Like there are many components to it.
There's a lot of individual
components are quite simple.
There's a lot to do, isn't there? There's a lot to do that you don't realize until you start doing it.
Mm.
Just how many things you have to do. And some of them, like you say, they're not difficult, but they can take a long time. Certain aspects of typesetting, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your experience of it so far then? Hemp Press started about a year ago, or just over a year ago?
We launched 1st of May 2022. So I think that's a year and a half-ish, right? Coming up.
So that's enough time to have a pretty good understanding of the way this industry works. I mean, so what do you think about it now? I mean, how has your view changed from when you started?
I think all of the horror stories I have of Hemp Press, I learned through Babel. So a lot of the challenges I already faced, if that makes sense, in terms of various levels of professionalism with writers and how the social media world can respond to you and things like that. So in terms of that, it is what it is. The great thing about it is having a small dedicated community, because I think that's what having a price tag on your material does. You do see who's willing to engage with you, and that's not to say that it's just limited to the people who buy your books, but you do encounter many people who aren't in a place to be spending X amount on a book, but are still happy to support you. And the really, really lovely thing, and this goes against the slightly facile take that only people who want to be published by you, by your books, and their family members, you know, is we had a lot of people who, as far as I can tell, at least on a public level, aren't writers.
There's a joke, and I have to say again, I think I've said this on the podcast before, but I'll say this again, this is a joke. I'm not being serious. Please don't, anyone listening, please don't attack me for this. But we have a joke that, you know, sales to family members count half, sales to other poets count a quarter. A sale to someone who isn't invested in any way and just wants it, that really matters. But it's a joke. Every sale is welcome and loved.
Yeah. Well, no, it's an interesting way to I know it's a joke, but it's an interesting hat to try on for a while and just to think with that, you know. I had every so often an order comes through and I do not recognize the name, and I search it in Twitter and Instagram, nothing comes up. I look at the address and it's nowhere near any of the writers I've published. So it's like, well, maybe they don't know the writers. And it's like, how did you hear about my weird little press? But then I was obviously, I slapped myself on the wrist and remember to be grateful, which I am, but it's just that initial hit of, but how did you find out about us? I definitely feel that.
Yeah. Well, it's a good feeling to know that you have this reach. Weirdly enough, I was just talking to somebody about this, that we can start to be fallen into the trap of thinking that our social media range is our world.
Mm.
And there are lots of people out there who don't engage with social media,
mm-hmm.
but they might have heard about Pentrap Press or Hem Press through somebody else, or they might have heard about us through a chain of people just talking in the real world, not online. And so word does spread still in the old fashioned ways.
Mm. Yeah, social media is not a closed circuit. That's the really important thing that Babel taught me, because with the newsletter, with the submissions we got, so many of the people who were writing to us said, oh, my friend told me about you because I know you from Twitter, this, and it's easy to think of Twitter as a echo chamber, and I think on the level of opinions it is. Like, I think the way information is circulated when it comes to political discussions, it very much goes around and around and around. And that's not representative of what goes on outside of social media. However, my experience of running a journal is, it's a very, very, I was going to say the word membrane, but I don't know anything about biology, but it's a very, very porous barrier between
membrane
and social media. Yeah. So it shouldn't be a surprise to people if their creative work floats outside of that world. But they can also be rest assured that a lot of the shallow political discussions that happens on social media also isn't represented in the wider world.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. But we can get onto the politics of poetry in a moment. I'd like to talk about Bear Bua Press, which is another press that started in the pandemic and closed recently. And I don't know if Michelle will be listening to this, but if Michelle's listening, I hope she knows that we wish her all the best. And if she ever chooses to return to the community, then she'll be welcomed by everyone worth being welcomed by.
Sure. I echo that. I was really, really grateful to have been with Bear Bua, because Michelle was the only person publishing the specific type of work that she was publishing, and with that amount of passion. I think the circumstances under which Bear Bua closed are, you know, they need to be addressed. Like, I can't brush that under the rug. I mean, I was very disappointed to see how the wider community responded to that. I don't think that was the mature or sensible way to do it. These anonymized accounts coding themselves in very specific imagery. And I disagree with that. By the same token, if Michelle was to return, and I hope she does, there's a conversation to be had about how that was dealt with before. And I think that's the whole point of a sincere and welcoming community, is to be able to have those types of discussions. But by the same token, she needs to be congratulated on the amount of work that she did, and the amount of careers that she's helped launch, and in terms of any challenges she's facing her end, I wish her all the best. I wish her family all the best, and I hope we get to see her soon.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we feel the same way about this, because it's interesting that you and I are both poets who run presses, but also we were both published by Bear Brewer just last year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not surprising that we have similar views on this. I think probably the most important one of those three is that we are publishers, so we can empathize with what Michelle might have been dealing with. I mean, we don't know about any personal issues, and it's not the purpose of this podcast to talk about that.
No.
But I think she published nearly 60 books in 2 years, which is a crazy amount of work. And I feel like I'm on the verge of burnout from publishing 10 books a year. So that's a lot of work, and it's perfectly understandable that she would just want to say, okay, I've had enough, especially given how thankless it can feel as a publisher.
Sure. Well, I think that's maybe why you and me can be quite, and I mean this positively, we can be quite defensive of other presses.
Yeah.
Because burnout is such a challenge. And like, I thought Hem was going to be slower than Babel, but it turns out publishing sort of an average of 2 books a quarter is a profoundly challenging, and the fact that Michelle did that amount in such a short space of time is extraordinary, definitely.
Do you think the problem can be that, for example, with Michelle, she thought for the first few months, even though it was a lot of hard work, it didn't matter about sales because she was enjoying it? And I say this from my own experience, that you can forget about the fact you're not making money because it feels like you're doing the right thing. You enjoy making books. So you get to see the book printed, you get to enjoy the finished product, and nothing else matters. But then after a point, it does start to matter, because the things you enjoy don't quite make up for all the things you don't enjoy as much as they used to. You know, all the hard work starts to play on your mind a bit more. The pleasure of seeing those books is diminished each time. And then there comes a point where you start to think, well, actually, I would quite like this to work as a business. I'd actually quite like people to appreciate what I'm doing. And if you're not getting that, then maybe it starts to feel like it's not worth the effort anymore.
Sure. So to maybe address the first piece of that, I think, and this is by no means limited to Michelle, I think for all of us, our biggest strength can also be our biggest weakness, and that's that we love to do this.
Mm.
We have the passion to do this. The reason why that's a weakness is because that's all we focus on. And so I can see how the route you just explained to kind of getting disillusioned with it, to maybe not enjoying the finished product as much as you want to just completely losing any heart. I can definitely understand that route, even if I haven't experienced it myself, thankfully. At the risk of sort of going back over myself, Michelle published a lot of books, and she published them passionately. And like me and we did announce this publicly, so I think it's okay to say it was me and JP Seabright had a book coming out, a collaborative book coming out of Biabua in January. And the initial 2024, and the initial conversations we had with Michelle was, I might not have enough room, But then because Michelle was so kind of just passionate and lovely and wanted to put more and more books out, she was like, oh, I'll take it. And again, that's a huge strength and a huge blessing. But also, especially with the gift of hindsight, I think, you know, we maybe wish she took care of herself at that time as well, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right about that strength being a weakness. That is a problem. Pentract has been going a bit longer than Hempress. So I can tell you that in my experience.
Are you guys 2015 then? That's when you launched.
It was 2016 we started.
2016.
And yeah, then 2018 we started books. So we were just doing leaflets for the first 2 years. And I can say, you know, it was more fun in the past. It's become less and less fun the more it becomes about having to think about the business side and having to think about covering costs and trying to make a profit. And, you know, I'm an artist. I'm not a businessman. I don't know how to be a businessman, but I have to think about these things. I can't just publish books that don't sell and think, well, that's fine. So the joy of making a book, and I still find that I still enjoy designing books, it's now starting to get a bit outweighed by this feeling of futility, I guess. You know, what's the point when the sales aren't getting big? In fact, the sales are getting worse, which I know is not just happening to me. It's happening to every press. The last 18 months have been bad for all presses. That's why so many have closed.
Mm.
But yeah, it can get demoralizing.
So if you don't want to go through this on record and edit what I'm about to say out, but where Pentract is now then is you guys, as far as I understand it, you guys are maybe keeping Pentract Press as an umbrella, but not no longer going to be putting Pentract books out after X amount of time, and then you're going to put that energy into imprints. Is that the case?
No, it's more like we've got 10 more books coming out over the next 12 or 13 months. But we don't, again, talking about Bear Boer, we don't want to just stop when we stop, if you see what I mean. We don't stop when we've stopped making books, because those books still exist and we want to make sure that every book we publish gets a good run. We also, I mean, it just seems very convenient too that we could stop in July 2026, which would be the 10th anniversary of when we started. So if we stop making new books at the end of next year, 2024, then we've got 18 plus months to promote the books we have. At the same time, we've also started a new press that's just going to do the occasional leaflet. That's called Rye Leopard. That's the name of the press. And so if it feels right, then we'll take over, we'll effectively replace Pentract Press with this new publishing company. But a lot of things, there are a lot of variables there.
Sure. So that, yeah, I mean, that when I was following your social medias around that time, that wasn't explicit to me, but
well, we haven't been clear about it, because we're not exactly clear in our own minds. We 2 years ago we thought we were going to quit. A year ago we thought we were going to quit. And the thing is that our reasons for wanting to quit are good, but those are business reasons. Then our reasons for carrying on are artistic reasons. So what we're thinking now is, if we wind down Pentract Press, then maybe we could start again with something that is art-based and not business-based. So we don't have to worry so much about making money and all of those other complications.
Because I guess the intention behind a leaflet imprint would be to keep your costs low on limited runs.
Yeah, exactly.
And make them back.
And then perhaps that could turn into something that makes books, but in a very manageable way, where we know that the costs aren't going to be a problem.
Sure.
But having a full publication schedule every year, where you know you're going to publish 10 books, for example, it's quite scary when you think, well, if all of these books fail, I mean, no book fails, but if none of these books sell in a good number, then that's us screwed. So that sort of thing is a bit scary. So
yeah,
it'd be good to do something where we can avoid that.
Yeah, I'm really grateful you just outlined that, because I'm sad to see Pentaract in its current form potentially end. But I think if you guys are more comfortable with the route you just explained, then more power to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of thinking about what your time is worth as well. But because at the moment we decided to be very strict on how many hours a day we work on this press, because before I was working nearly 50 hours a week on Pentaract Press for a salary that would equate to less than minimum wage by a long way. That's no way to live your life, especially when you're not enjoying it. And like I say, certain aspects of it I definitely enjoyed, but there were many aspects that I didn't. So, as you know, there are lots of really tedious things you have to do as a publisher.
Yeah. Yes. You have my solidarity and my respect for being able to admit that to yourselves and be able to put the sort of announcements that you did out into the public arena. Because it's not an easy thing to do. And I think any press that can handle that with a degree of self-awareness should be celebrated. But I'm also feeling it with him up to a point. I think after 2024, beg your pardon, in 2024, I'm going to go to one a quarter. Mm. And then after 2024, I'm going to have a rest, because I've put a lot of books out over the course of what will be 3 years. But then I'll play it by ear, I think. I mean, 3 books a year, that would be nice. Because also, like, there are some challenges coming down the line that we don't know what's going to we don't know how hard they're going to hit yet, in terms of digital currencies, you know, rising, and in terms of how different supply chains might function, and how overseas orders, which are a bit of a headache for me at the moment, might work. So 2020, and in terms of some of the, a little bit of the forecasting that I can, that I've read about, they're all putting it at the end of 2024 anyway, that we're going to have a better idea about what all that's going to look like. So for him, having a pause at the end of 2024 will give me time to get my shit together and see how it can work. Moving forward, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of about 3 or 4 books a year is, that's really good. That seems like a manageable amount, and that's probably what we will do if we decide to build this current leaflet press we have into a full press. I think anything beyond that is too much. You know, the 10 to 12 books we've been publishing every year for the last few years is it's too many. It's too much work. It just drags you down.
Mm. And you beat me to it, man, because a leaflet press was something I wanted. Oh, I'm sorry to do it, obviously, but it's something that I wanted to do with him. And it's like, God damn it, Anthony beat me to it.
Well, beat you to it. What, 6 years ago, 7 years ago? Because that's how the press started. Okay. We have. I'll send you some if I have some lying around of the old leaflets.
Sure, that'd be lovely.
So yeah, sorry, this has gone very dark and negative, but we have to acknowledge this. And I always think, I mean, and thank you for saying that we're open on Twitter about what we think and about where we're going, because we do try to be very transparent. You know, we don't want to lie to people. We want to say, look, we're struggling here, things are not going well, but we also say when things are going well. So I think that's important.
Sure.
But let's be more positive anyway. Let's talk about, let's move on. Let's talk about poetry and your poetry. You kind of mentioned your main inspirations earlier, but I know, so the language poets, in particular, Charles Bernstein, will be big influences on you. And anything else?
I guess, so in terms of strictly literary influences, certainly the language poets. When I got into poetry and I kind of realized I was interested in these messy, entangled historical narratives we refer to as the avant-garde. I got into poetry and started taking it more seriously. And certainly British poetry at the time didn't have any interest in that sort of work. There were independent presses going. They weren't quite as joined up as they are now. So I think although I could access American and Canadian material quite easily, because they really, really knew how to use the internet. We hadn't quite got there with UK poetry. I mean, we certainly hadn't got there with UK avant-garde writing. So I was very much kind of forced into straight-laced lyric poetry. And while I've got a lot of criticisms around the motto, you need to know the rules before you break them, I do see a degree of worth in having a pretty conservative training in poetry in terms of your meter, your rhyme, your form. And I threw some shade towards Jane Austen earlier, but it's precisely because I went through that experience of learning the nitty-gritty of poetics that I could not only learn an appreciation of, but actively read Wordsworth and Keats and Blake and
exactly, but yeah,
John Donne, you know.
Yeah, this is why I tell people it's important to learn about prosody. It's not just to help you be a better writer; it's to help you enjoy works that already exist.
Mm.
You know, your appreciation is heightened by this knowledge. But it's very interesting the relationship between traditionalism and avant-gardism. And in my own work, it's a constant struggle between the two. But sometimes I just want to write very traditional poetry, and then sometimes I want to just tear it all up and, well, deconstruct it and put it together in a different configuration and mess around with it or add constraints to it. So I'm not sure if I like the idea of the avant-garde as a thing. I'm not even sure what it means. Well, I know what it literally means, but how do you approach that idea of avant-garde poetry? Because surely any poetry that is creative is breaking new ground. And that's what all artists should be doing anyway.
Okay, so going by the assumptions I've seen in just conversations I've had in the poetry world, as well as what I've seen online, there's an assumption that avant-garde means cutting edge and ahead of the curve. And there are plenty of examples we can point to in the history of the avant-garde where, you know, the various different artists said that they were doing that. However, that's not the whole story. So I think if we maybe start everybody who has any investment in the avant-garde is going to roll their eyes now because I'm going to say that thing. But I mean, if we just go back to that term avant-garde and it being a
militaristic
term, yeah, for reconnaissance mission, it was quite deliberately framed in political terms, and not in the terms of a military front line being at the forefront of aesthetics. It was quite decidedly political. And it was political mainly in terms of anti-war and class struggles. So we see this in Zaoum, we see this in Dadaism and they're moving to Switzerland. Even with the artists who said that they were ahead of the curve, once we drill down on their statements, we realize that they were doing that for political reasons. So we see this with the futurists. We see this with Ezra Pound. So I don't like the idea of newness in that sense, and I don't like the idea of the cutting edge. I much prefer difference as a term, an aesthetic difference. And the different factions of the avant-garde would use aesthetic difference to attack the bourgeoisie. Again, it was certainly in the earlier days a decidedly political move. So instead of framing the avant-garde in terms of the cutting edge, I'm very, very fond of what Brian Gysin said about the museums of modern art, which was a new thing when he was alive, you know. When art had to be modern, it had to be, I think he uses the phrase, it had to be rolled out like a winter clothing catalogue. And I think we can make the same criticism of the cutting edge definition of the avant-garde. But even the artists who said they were being ahead of the curve were doing it for political reasons. I think that was the main sort of point I was trying to get to. So once we make that move away from the cutting edge and assumes cutting edge to the investigation of different underlying social structures, which is a very, you know, $100 way to put it, but that, then what we're left with is a far more generous and open definition of the avant-garde. And it doesn't have to be grand. It doesn't have to be past war necessarily. You know, it doesn't have to be anti-nationalistic, although that's also a huge part of what the avant-garde did throughout history. I think there's a good lesson to learn with the Ulipo group, because when we look at their material, it's not explicitly political. I mean, Perec gets spoken about in terms of his family being killed in the Holocaust, and maybe writing a novel about the letter E is a way to address absence. I can't yet find any material where Perec is saying that's what he was doing. That seems to me to be a critical response to avoid. So if we look at Ulipo, they're still playing with underlying structures. It's just the structure of the bourgeois novel. And again, like, are they actively critiquing the bourgeois? Probably in some cases, that's how they thought. Like, that's how they thought of it. But it doesn't have to be this grandiose statement. It can very much be structure on the level of what we pattern our narratives on, you know? So, I mean, I'm just very conscious this is a long explanation, but just to finish maybe on, if that's avant-garde, what isn't avant-garde? Okay, so this is my problem with the term experimental, and why I don't like it, ultimately, is it's relative to whoever's writing. And so you'll get quite decidedly conservative poets who are putting their poems into columns so it can be read three ways, you know, the two columns and then a cross. And, you know, that's been done many, many times throughout history, but it's an experiment for them, you know. My exception to this is Christian. Like, if you're in a lab encoding whatever on earth he's doing with DNA strands, then you're being experimental. Like, you can have that. Like, that's what an experimental poet is. That's literally an experiment. But in terms of experimentation, in terms of a formal play, again, I just think that's far more relative to each individual writer, and this sense of every artist is breaking new ground. That's what I want to push against as well, because I mean, you know, Fluxus initially called themselves neo-Dada. Like, they were quite consciously referring back to Dadaism, even though they were an avant-garde movement, and they were picking up those breadcrumbs, you know. And indeed, a lot of the avant-garde has repeated itself to an extent. We can draw a line from conceptual writing and radical found language practices through Cathy Acker, through Boas, through Tristan Tzara, and arguably further on through Chaucer and Shakespeare. It's a form of play, certainly, and I think every artist is compulsed to play. But again, I butt against this idea of breaking new ground simply because I come back to Geisen's criticism that once art has to be modern, then it has to, you know, be rolled out like a winter clothing catalogue. Having said all that, I do greatly respect, you know, what Christian Buch does, being able to point to the artists who were experimenting with structures and then be able to build out a whole sci-fi aesthetic as he has done. Yeah. Is greatly original.
I would think about it more in terms of, and I wouldn't call this avant-garde because I've seen too many avant-garde artists not do this, but I would say that one of the most important things to do as an artist isn't just to create something, it's to create a new way of doing art. I'm being very careful not to use the term cutting edge because I know you hate it, but that's the important thing.
I agree with that.
Yeah. So if you could invent a new art form, that would be something truly revolutionary that is important. See, I say revolutionary instead of cutting edge. Which is in some ways an even worse way of saying cutting edge.
Yeah, I think the what we predicate our ideas of newness and oldness on is fundamentally, flimsy. And I say that for all of us, as a culture. I think newness, what's that story of Picasso when he went to the caves of Lascaux and he looked at the cave paintings and he came back up? And the first thing he said is, "We have learned nothing." This idea of newness is oftentimes a reimagining of the old. And I recently read Lyrical Ballads, which I'd read before in anthologies and collected editions, but I'd never read the whole book from start to finish before, so I did that. And in the preface, Wordsworth is going on about experiments. These poems are experiments in, he didn't use these terms, but effectively everyday speech in informal poetry. So not only is the new old, but the old can quite often be far more new than we thought it was. So I think there's a lot of worth in causing trouble to these ideas as well.
Yeah, and there's a problem with the with using the term avant-garde to make you sound like you're, as you said before, cutting edge, and to make you sound like you're doing something really revolutionary. And the good example of that is something we were talking about before we started recording. We were talking about typewriters.
Mm.
Whenever you see typewriter poetry, people refer to it as avant-garde. But sure. Of course, typewriter poetry has been around a long time. In fact, mm-hmm. It's been around as long as the typewriter has. So it's, how is that not actually traditional poetry now? You know, when does something have to be old enough to become a tradition?
Well, sure. I think the point that started the whole foray into this topic were my influences as a writer, and this is kind of one of the points. Like, I was reading the Beats and the New York School, but those poets have already been for the most part absorbed into Bernstein's official verse culture. Are they still avant-garde? I mean, we can certainly go back to them and get a lot of energy from them. And we can talk in terms of a historical avant-garde, you know. We see this with a lot of the sort of late modernist and post-war poets, this use of the everyday speech. But now, you know, I was reading this month's poetry magazine this week, and a lot of the very, very good poems I read in there, if they were published in 1960, they would have been, you know, radical writing. So here's an interesting point. My next book is typewriter poetry. And
okay, so is it avant-garde or is it traditional?
Well, I always say that I'm writing in relation to the avant-garde. I don't think I've ever said I'm an avant-garde poet, but certainly the avant-garde is my is how I orient my intellectual landscape, you know. And I think maybe the way I'd begin to think about that is the form of typewriter poetry is no longer, you know, avant-garde. Although I'll repeat that what I mean by that isn't new. What I mean by that is playing with the fundamental structures of our culture. Typewriters aren't meant to be used to draw images.
It's not being used for its intended purpose.
Exactly.
That's one way of looking at it.
Yeah. So in this way, it's
a subversion.
Yeah, it's a subversion of the underlying material structures of our culture. Taking a piece of writing equipment that's meant to write prose and using it to make images. So in that sense, typewriter poetry may not be avant-garde. But you know, but if that piece is no longer avant-garde, then what are you doing with it? Like, are you responding to the history of typewriter poetry? And in that sense, are you, if you're not being avant-garde there, are you at least again thinking in relation to the avant-garde? I think I'd maybe begin to orient my thoughts in that direction. And just to kind of broaden out the conversation as well, I'm very, very fond of Mike Kelly, the late great American artist. And his definition of art was it was a ritual activity that runs parallel to the activities of popular culture. And I think he uses the term, it splays popular culture. And it messes with it in that sense. And I think that is a good definition of as any, not just for the avant-garde, but maybe for art in general. Because if you're not messing with the structures of culture, then you're reinforcing them. So not only is in a Marvel movie not avant-garde, but is a Marvel movie art? Or is it just well crafted?
Maybe you've already hit upon a better way to explain these things by saying about subverting intended uses or subverting. If I could talk about my own work, maybe in subverting the sonnet form by doing weird things with it, maybe that's the avant-gardist in me more than the part of me that's trying to do something new. Maybe it's more subverting the existing.
I think so too. I would definitely put your work in relation to that. I was really, really interested to see you and Clara, you went to see Penn and Teller recently. You put it on your social media, and that was so fascinating to me because obviously Penn and Teller were famous for not doing the trick and then telling people how they did it, which is such a perfect way to think about palindromes and writing constraints. Like you write the poem and then you show your hand at the end of it.
I've had this conversation with Penn.
Well, that's interesting to know, because I know that he blurbed one of your books as well, and then but in that sense you're revealing the underlying structure of what you're doing as well, and you're not only playing with formal poetry, but you're playing with the assumptions form is based on as well, I think.
Yeah.
But I think you were going to say about the conversation you had.
Yeah, just about well, that's it really. That this is a, I think is something that Penn and I have in common, that we like that idea of just respecting tradition, the tradition of magic, but also wanting to kind of mess with it a bit. Yeah, so it's interesting. So we're gonna now we enter dangerous territory, I guess. We have to bring politics in. You said something before, and I thought that was a good way to lead into this, but I've forgotten what it was. So you'll have to remind me when we get to it. So let's talk about politics and poetry and the relationship. I've been yelled at on Twitter a few times when I've said that I reject the notion that all art is political. My views have actually softened a bit on this, and I'm starting to think, well, I don't think all art is political, but I don't have any problem with other people feeling this way. And I think if people want to map politics onto art in a way that makes them appreciate the art more, fine. And I've got one very good example of this, which just happens to involve a horror movie, so we'll enjoy that too, which is Night of the Living Dead,
mm-hmm.
which of course is, to a lot of people, it serves as a great allegory for, or metaphor for, racial issues in America in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But George Romero didn't intend any of that. The main reason that the main character is black, he just gave the best audition for the role.
Sure.
Black and white actors were auditioned. But if it makes people enjoy the film more, reading that into it, I'm okay with that. So my stance now on this art being political thing is, if you want to, if it enhances your appreciation of a work of art to map your politics onto it, that's okay with me. But don't expect me to accept your political interpretation of a work of art. Do you see what I mean?
I do, yeah. I guess the first thing we should say is for the edification of the listener. We're both into horror movies, and we'll be talking about it later. But that's yeah. why you're bringing Romero into it. So there's a number of things to talk about here, and I am thinking about where to begin. So let's just define our positions on this, as because you were very generous in explaining yours just then. So I don't like to frame it in terms of the political, because then it puts all art in relation to the state, and it defines all art in relation to the state. Mm-hmm. So instead, I say all art is social. All art exists in the social realm. And on that level, I believe every artist needs to consider, at least try and consider, what their work might mean on the social realm, or bigger part, in the social realm. So I don't like political because it puts everything in relation to the state. I much prefer social. But again, going back to the idea of, does an avant-garde that play with structure need to be grandiose? Well, no, it doesn't. It can do that despite omitting letter E from a structure, you know. Likewise, does the social have to be grandiose? And no, I don't believe it does. It just needs to be a consideration. So I do refuse the idea of in the terms that people describe it. Again, I don't like the word political in this context, but in the terms that people describe it, I do refuse the idea of an apolitical art. And I need to bring in a death of the author, I'm afraid. So Barthes' big thing with the death of the author that I think people miss is that it came from his readings of Freud. And this is like, in part, he also brought in left activist thinkers. But the key thing with bringing in Freud to the death of the author is it's like a master lock, a master key that kind of just opens the theory from this quite facile discussion around does the author have a say in his or her or their writing, to something far more generative and interesting, which is the author's unconscious desires manifest in their writing and they don't know it's happening. And that happens on the level of of the cultures they were raised in. The way I think about this is we're all, and again, this is very much to do with my engagement with horror movies, we're all possessed by the signifiers of our culture. And it's precisely because of that that they're going to worm their way into to the things we make. So with A Night of the Living Dead, which, and you didn't know this, but I rewatched it pretty recently as well, and it's just wonderful. But again, Romero is or let's say infected, because it's a zombie film, is infected by the signifiers of his culture just as much as anyone else's. So this is horribly simplistic to put it in these terms, but if Romero was a racist, how would that film would have looked?
Yeah. That's true. It's true that you could probably watch that film and, well, you could certainly watch that film and know that Romero is not racist.
Right.
But I mean, in a way, it's giving you an insight into his political viewpoint.
Yeah, and his gender politics aren't, you know, terrible in that film either. In terms of the female co-lead. So, and again, like if we look at the Living Dead franchise as well, he did go on to make movies that were quite specifically about, and he would say this in interviews, consumerism.
Yeah, Dawn of the Dead is exactly, I mean, there's no denying that the politics of that is intentional.
Right, and Land of the Living Dead was, which is for people who don't know, the far, far later one, I think he did it in the late 2000s, sorry, 2010s, I think, oh, don't quote me on that. But and it was very, very much a response to Bush. So even Romero does have this social impulse, as I would describe it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they would be my main 2 points. All art exists in the social realm, but I would argue, hopefully, not the political realm. And the social is far more; it's far wider, in that it can contain folks' various political associations, but it can also contain things that are far more humble and far more quieter as well, you know. And then the second big point I would raise is we're all possessed by our culture anyway. So, like, you know, Romero didn't intend for Night of the Living Dead to be about race or the Vietnam War. Well, tough. Like, it can't work that way, because your language doesn't come from inside of us. It comes from outside of us, and it's been put inside of us. So we're going to be putting it back out into the world, you know.
Well, I agree with all that, but it's undeniable that what we are, and therefore what art we make, is this hodgepodge of different ideas and experiences that just lie in our unconscious minds, and we can't help them, we don't really understand them, and they're going to come out. I mean, that's what it is to be a living being, I suppose. Your actions are going to be determined by things that are buried deep within you that you're not conscious of. But my problem with this is that's really complicated. That's they're so buried that nobody, no stranger, can come along and tell you that they know what's going on in your unconscious mind.
But I mean, this is the insight of psychoanalysis, in that we're even estranged to ourselves. So I certainly agree that I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that somebody might come along and say that they know what your politics are based on what you're writing, which I think is how I'm hearing. Hearing you say they know what my unconscious mind is.
Yeah. I mean, for example, I mean, I'd be a very difficult person to analyze here, because I spend a lot of time writing very traditional conservative poetry, aesthetically conservative, that is. So would people read that and say, well, he writes a lot of sonnets, he must be politically conservative? But if they only ever see those, that's what they'll think. But then if they only ever see my more subversive, should we say, let's not use avant-garde, my more subversive works, will they think, oh, he must be a radical?
Do you write conservative formal poetry? I don't believe you do. Like from my reading of you, like even when you're writing sonnets or Ottava Rimas or Spenserian sonnets, you're not you're doing it with only using two letters or whatever the fuck, you know. So I don't believe...
No, I do also write in a very traditional way sometimes.
Okay.
I just don't feel like my aesthetic choices have much to do with my political outlook.
Okay, so that actually highlights a really important thing, because what you say there is assuming a link between aesthetics and ethics, which if I knew
that this is what a lot of people are doing.
Okay, so if I that wasn't explicit to me, so I'm glad that you clarified that, because I was talking more broadly about just a creative practice in general. And whether or not one's, you know, whether or not that's necessarily a political act or not. If we're talking specifically about aesthetics versus one's political convictions, rather, the history of the avant-garde denies this entirely. We have Pound and his fascist sympathies on one hand, and we have the radical left-wing Jewish modernists on the other, like Oppen and like Zaworski, who we could sensibly say they're all in the same aesthetic ballpark, but they're definitely not in the same ethical ballpark, you know. So because this was my main preoccupation when I was at uni, like, is there a link between aesthetics and ethics? And after like really banging my head against the plot, there isn't. There just isn't. So somebody like Jericho Brown. So if he writes quite formally conservative poetry, like, is he a conservative? Well, no. He's written very, very passionately about Black rights for his whole career, you know. And we see this with some of the more well-known poetry prizes in England. Like, I think Joel won the T.S. Eliot not long ago for their radically LGBTQ plus writing. And
last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was last year or the year before. I can't remember, but I think
the last few years have been a blur. Yeah,
something like that. But again, like, we can point to Pound, we can point to not all the futurists, as some people think, but a lot of the, like, a fair bulk of them were sympathizers to Mussolini. And it's even with my beloved Deleuze and Guattari, they've been picked up for some quite problematic philosophers like Nick Land and taken into some quite concerning places, you know. Yeah. Is that a fault with Deleuze and Guattari? Of course it is. It's a fault with, although some people say it is, but I believe it's a fault with the way they've been picked up and utilised, which is the one of the dangers with a philosophy as generous as theirs. The point being is ethics and aesthetics doesn't really have any meaningful link is what I would say.
I'd like to go back to what we were talking about before, but you keep saying interesting things. You're being too interesting.
I have to
ask other questions. So I take it that you would have a good answer to the question about separating art from artist.
Well, I've never met Shakespeare, you know. So do I know the artist? Again, we need to problematize the binary. I mean, I think we also need to bring knowing into doubt as well. And I think we need to be, when I say we, I mean, you know, as a critical community, I think we maybe need to focus on the way we know the artist based on whatever text, and the way we know the text based on how we read. So it's not so much it's a terrible answer if you want something clear, but I think it needs to be undone as an idea more than anything.
Okay, I'll accept that. My answer is on the separation of art from artists, my answer is, well, how much does the artist make their art about themselves? Like, it's very hard to separate Bill Cosby from his art when he's made himself such a big part of his art. So we can't watch The Cosby Show again the same way.
Okay, that's what I needed. I needed a specific example. I think I had too much to go with.
I know. Well, because I keep throwing the conversation around, but this is because there are so many things I want to talk to you about.
No, it's all good. Like, I'm glad that you gave me that. So I think there's going to be a large portion of listeners who butt against this, and understandably so. But I would say I will take this into a different direction at the end. Something that's really, really valuable to me in thinking through these issues was auteur theory. Now, being a horror fan, you've got Rosemary's Baby, therefore we've got Polanski. I think another example we could bring in would be Woody Allen and Annie Hall. And I think, you know, Annie Hall is a movie which is very much based on Woody Allen and his character, and it is such an idiosyncratic movie in how it's structured. If we dismiss these movies on the basis of the truly upsetting actions of their creators, then we actually dismiss everyone else who worked on those movies as well. So this is to say quite decisively that auteur theory is wrong. It is always a collaborative act. It is always a an act of many, many labourers, and should their actions just ruin the livelihoods of everybody else, which is kind of what we're necessarily doing if we dismiss these movies out of hand. I don't believe they so should. Now, the direction I would take this in is, would I still watch Bill Cosby? I don't think I would.
But then you mentioned Rosemary's Baby. Okay, Rosemary's Baby. It doesn't matter if you were told someone else directed it, you could still enjoy it.
I'm very much.
He's right there. Bill Cosby is right there. That's
the difference, isn't it? It's because I am thinking about this out loud, and I think the difference is Cosby is front and center of the Cosby Show. You know,
It's meant to be. He's playing a character, but it's a character that's meant to be him still. It's still meant to have a lot of who he really is in it.
Sure. Well, same with Woody Allen. But does that discount Diane Keaton's performance? Like, of course it doesn't. Does it discount his co-writer? I don't think it does. So I think we're very much having this conversation with the spectre of social media in the background and how those conversations play out in. How this conversation might play out in those forums. And it's complicated because life is complicated. The things that Cosby and Allen and Polanski have done or have alleged to have done, however you want to say it, are wrong. Like, that's not complicated. That's very, very simple. But in terms of how we engage with these texts and how we engage with this conversation, that's not a clean cut thing at all. And so I'd maybe hope that instead of holding us to, you know, the specific things that we've spoken about in that sort of topic, I hope people hold us to the spirit of the conversation and trying to work through it in a welcoming and gracious way.
Yeah, people will, because this is a podcast. It's a weird. If I were to take some of the things I've said on this podcast and just with stripped of all nuance and just tweeted them, I'd be attacked. I mean, that's basically happened. It's a strange place, social media. It's almost like it's designed to cause conflict.
It is designed to cause conflict. I mean, that's it wants you to log on every day and it wants to make you feel like your opinions are being justified no matter what they are. And it wants to do that so you can see the advertisers on the feed. You can get advertised to. It's as simple as that. It's in the same way, I think, growing up with TV functions by fulfilling desires which are actually good. Our desires, like pleasure and like sex and like belonging and like family, like these are good things, but the basis on which TV tried to sell us things is the thing that's wrong. Whereas this is a bit of a hot take, but I think maybe social media is trying to pander to our far darker needs and desires around vengeance and around revenge and around bullying, you know?
Yeah. And also, I think anyway, it's just the nature of text reduced to sound bites, stripped of all emotion, stripped of all human expression and intonation. It always is going to sound creepy. You're going to be drawn to the worst possible interpretation of what's being said.
Yeah, I'll take that. I think many people will, if they're not aware of how they engage with social media.
So I was going to say one more thing about the going back to Night of the Living Dead. If somebody watches that film and enjoys it and they don't have any political interpretation of it, are they not getting as much from the film as the people who have that political interpretation? Or is their enjoyment of the film just as valid?
It's certainly just as valid, but we're approaching quite a difficult conversation around inner experience and how somebody might process that. But also, if this hypothetical audience watches Night of the Living Dead and they get something out of it and they think they're just enjoying it, but unbeknownst to them, there's a deeper reason why they're getting something out of it, then, you know, like, that's surely still valid, even if they don't know. I mean, there are many different types of people in the world. Just because someone can't relate to something intellectually doesn't mean they can't relate to something intuitively or emotionally. You know the intention of which I'm saying. This is not aimed at you, but just in terms of that broad conversation, it's a bit of a non-question to me, because people are going to take away what they take away from it. And I think
to me it's a non-question.
But the real value of it is what happens after they watch the movie and how are those conversations going to play out. Like, that's where it is for me, you know.
If there is a political interpretation, whether correct or incorrect, that's not the most important thing about the work of art. The work of art is just engaging people in whatever way it does engage them.
Okay, so are you not saying then that somebody who watches a movie and doesn't see anything political about it, it therefore invalidates the politics of the movie?
Well, that would depend on the artist's intentions. So if it's, you know, if you're watching JFK, for example, and somebody watches that and doesn't find anything political in it, I might say either the director's done a bad job or the viewer has not got the point. But a film that's ambiguous as to whether or not it's political, intentionally ambiguous, that's a different matter. I think, let's say the films of David Lynch, for example, is there a correct way to interpret those?
Well, I think Lynch in particular, I see Lynch in terms of a horror director. Like, he makes horror movies for the most part, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think the horror in Lynch is really, really getting beneath understanding and how we think we know. So like, if we're talking about Lynch and interpretation, it's like the best thing I ever heard about Lynch actually was from Connor Habib, who's a podcaster, who just wrote a novel and he used to be a gay porn star and he's had a very exciting life. But the best thing I ever heard about Lynch was from him, which is In Lynch's movies, whenever anybody tries to investigate their mystery, they get fucked. Like, the whole film falls apart. And usually in Lynch, this is to do with a character going into a dark corner. So it happens in Lost Highway, it happens in Inland Empire, it happens in Mulholland Drive, it happens in Eraserhead. The camera slowly zooms in to a shadow or a dark corner because the character is going off and investigating something there. And that's when the movie gets weird, you know? And so I think as far as Habib is concerned, it's the interpretation is the horror. I would take away from that, you know? So I think Lynch if we're talking about how to interpret art, which is the sort of underlying tone here, Lynch maybe isn't the best. Let's go back to Land of the Dead, because that's a movie that, on the surface, it's a straight-up zombie movie. Like, people can enjoy it there. And in interviews, Romero said it's about the Iraq War. So I think like that movie can maybe work on both levels, you know.
Well, I certainly think if an artist of any kind says this is a political work, then I think it has to be interpreted politically. I don't think you can just dismiss that and say no, it isn't. I would go along with that. You know, like we discussed earlier, most of the music I listened to was punk rock. A lot of that is overtly political, and I'm not going to pretend it isn't.
I think what I'd say is, and this is going back to what I feel about being possessed by the signifiers of our culture. That can certainly happen by an artist trying to create movies and there being a tremendous amount of political interpretations. But I also think the inverse can be true, where an artist can try and sit down and make a really political film. We see this with Alex Cox's films all the time. Like, they're so fun. Like, I forget they're meant to be serious political movies. Like Repo Man and Sid and Nazi and those sort of films. It's like, the opposite can be true, where the artist tries to sit down and make a political thing, but what actually comes out is something far more buoyant and far more colourful, you know. So it's the same. It's just the same. I frame it exactly the same way. Not only can seemingly innocent acts exist in the social realm, which again is how I would want to emphasize it, but acts that are full of social importance can also be quite fun.
And that's where this episode abruptly ends. What followed was a conversation about horror movies so long that it became its own episode. Expect that on October 31st. Thank you for listening.